Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I am Renee Komen, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey. It's good to be back here.
Yes, yes.
In this dump.
Sure.
They call Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge. You know. But it's nice. It's all right.
Yeah, same as it ever was. Hasn't changed much over
there. Smells worse than me.
Okay.
Let's just put it that way.
Well, that's good. That's
it's
positive.
Smells worse than me. And speaking of lounges, did you know that a lounge that we used to go to a lot, the Milan Lounge, closed down?
You know, I saw that in the newspaper today.
Yeah, after like, I don't know, 60 years or something, they closed down.
Now, I didn't read why they were closing down, did you?
I did not see that either. I don't know why they closed down. Maybe it was just time to call it quits. Maybe, you know, they were like in a residential little area.
Well, and you know, it was one of the last, or at least the last time I went there was probably 10 years ago, but it was a buzzer bar.
Right.
You know, you go and you knock on the glass and they look at you, and if they recognize you, then they buzz you in. If they don't, they just wave you off.
Well, we used to go there, I think, when I first met you, and we would go there and they'd buzz us in, and those were good times.
Yes, I remember,
because
I
lived right around the corner. Remember, I lived on General Pershing and they were right on Milan Street.
I kind of forgot
I was roommates with my friend who killed himself, Casey Butler. He died about a year ago with the rope around the neck thing.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, they wouldn't let him into the club.
Oh, well.
they wouldn't buzz him in, so he decided to call it quits.
That's no way to handle that kind of information,
he's a good
just
guy.
Just go to another bar.
Yeah, well, he did.
They'll let anybody in
they would buzz you
Monkey
in.
Monkey Hill Bar.
And it was a Chicago Cubs bar.
Okay.
I remember. But those were good times when we were fucked up. Going in there and having fun.
I remember being there a few times, but it was always nice.
So they closed down. Speaking of lounges, they closed down. I don't know why. I really don't. I haven't been there in years.
Right.
I don't do H anymore.
Sure.
So I don't go there anymore.
Everything in its time.
Yeah. So what else is going on?
Oh, you know, what else is going on? Let's see. I played a gig with new artist Cole Williams at the Congo Square Festival this week. Had a couple of other club gigs with the great Lynn Drury. And now I'm going into a rehearsal marathon with French Quarter Fest coming up. But that's kind of neither here nor there. We've been seeing all the stuff in the news about the deportations and everything. Well, it didn't take long for it to hit close to home. Already some people that I know.
Really?
One of them was deported under some dicey circumstances where his kids were coming into the country or something with valid visas, and they passport control, they kind of held them. They said, well, you need to come pick up your kids and everything will be fine. They did, and they had him and the two girls on a deportation plane 2 hours later back to his home country.
Who is this person?
Nobody but...
then why bring it up?
Well, because I don't know.
You're not going to name names.
No, I'm definitely not going to name names in this situation.
Why bring it up? Nobody cares if you don't bring it up.
Well, I don't think the names are important. I think the.
Was he a musician?
No. He was a contractor, carpenter, and then his roommate saw that was already happening and decided,
to rent his room out.
I need to go back to my home country. And another guy is another roommate's in detention. So man, oh man, and all these guys are people that like you would let in your house, give them a set of keys, they could be there while I was gone. They wouldn't trust them with anything with my life. But there you go.
So there was no reason for this.
Well, I guess they're whatever.
They must have some kind of record or something.
Their immigration status was not. I don't know. It made them all targets that Well, you know, and
I think we're all going to be targets, whether we're citizens or not.
Well, particularly you and I. Yeah,
we're all going to be targets. So, well, if you don't name names, then I don't really care.
All right. Well, I'm not going to. I think that would be not very wise to. Yeah. Not that it would make any difference to you.
Well,
anyway.
Well, maybe
you
a lawyer out there would try to help them.
I think an immigration lawyer. In these days. Hopefully they have all that, but you know, naming people's names over the radio.
So, what country do you think they're going to? One of those El Salvadorian prisons?
I don't know. I mean, I think one guy went back to his home country. The other guy was deported back to his home country. The other guy voluntarily left before they could nab him here. And because, of course, you know, if they pick you up in some kind of circumstance, these guys are so incompetent, you don't know what they're going to do. They could send you to. Yeah, El Salvadorian prison that, you know, even if you're only there for a few days, you know, it's you're there with rapists and killers, man. You know, your life could end in a matter of hours being among
them.
Well,
did you say to them, nice knowing you, as they got booked?
I didn't even get to see it. I only heard the aftermath of the thing.
Used to it. A lot more people you know are going to be deported.
That's a terrible thing.
It's a horrible thing. But, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing the country. I haven't traveled in years.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you're talking about Guam, but maybe you know, you get a free ride somewhere else, man.
Yeah,
you know,
you do have North Dakota. That seems like a good place.
Okay, I don't think that's where they're going to deport you to.
North Dakota, you know. So I've been doing lately since Mardi Gras is, and this is something we can all do. It might help you out, you know. For Lent, I've been telling people, you know, I've been bumping into people the last couple of weeks, people that I can't stand, you know, I really don't care for them.
Sure, well, that could be almost anybody.
Yeah, and they go, hey, Manny, how you doing? And I pull out this card saying, I've given up talking for Lent.
Ah.
So I say, I can't talk to you. I've given it up for Lent. See you later. I just wave.
Taking a vow of silence.
Yeah, I just say, I can't do this. You know,
I think I'm going to try that.
Yeah, you should. It works, man. They're like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And, you know, you can't have a conversation because I don't carry a notepad with a pen or anything. I just say, see you later. Bye-bye. And it works with people you can't stand, which for me is pretty much everyone.
Right.
You know? So I've used that card the last few weeks since Mardi Gras.
All right.
And it's been working.
Okay.
You know, it hasn't worked on my wife, though.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked on that.
It's not taking the hint?
No. But anyway, so that's been going on. What else is happening with you?
What else is happening with me? Well, I went to a big social event that I thought you perhaps might be at, but alas, you were not there. It was over at our good friend Jeff Treffinger's house. It was a wedding party for Glenn Hartman and his new bride, Jen, and it was a great collection of New Orleans musicians it's a lot of fellowship, getting to talk to some people I don't normally see in those kind of relaxed situations. And you know, it's funny, you can know somebody for years, or, you know who they are, be around them, but never get in a big conversation. Then you finally do, and
you realize you can't stand them.
Well, no. You realize that they have all these super interesting things in their past that you know, that really resonate with you, and you go, wow, now I see you in a whole new light. So you never know until you start asking people. That's one reason I like having this podcast, you know, because even people I feel like I know well, once I prepare for the to come in here and do a deep dive, I find out all kind of other really interesting things about them.
Oh, okay. Well, good for you.
All right. Okay. Well, you know, it's a special day today. I thought you might have had some special bit prepared for this. No.
Oh yeah.
What day is today? Tuesday.
Well, it's the 1st of April, Manny.
Oh, no, I don't do that. Yeah. Come on.
Well, you've done it before.
I'm better than that,
you've done it before on the podcast.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
All right.
Well, you know, maybe this will coincide with April Fools. You know, a story I read in the state of Texas.
Oh, okay.
Now, that's a crazy state, that state.
Sure.
Texas, you know. They got all sorts of problems going over there. But a woman, they discovered this woman a few months back. I think it was over the holidays, and they found her chopped up to pieces, like chopped up into like 100 pieces or something.
That's a lot of
this
pieces.
Was a town, I think, right outside of Galveston.
Galveston, yeah.
Galveston.
Okay,
and,
sure.
They,
I guess that's an alternate pronunciation.
You know, well, hey, listen, they say, what do they do down here? Instead of Burgundy, they say Burgundy. Yeah,
sure, okay. It's all Burgundy. Right. Taking the New Orleans pronunciation.
Yeah, it's
right.
A Burgundy thing.
CL-10.
Yeah,
instead of Clio.
Yeah. Or Houston and Houston.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah, no. Sorry, but anyway, in this Galveston town, they found this woman. She was chopped up to like 128 pieces.
Oh, more than 100.
And the coroner, they still don't know who did this or whatever. But the coroner, this is how crazy this is. The coroner ruled it a suicide. So I don't know what that's about because I guess you know
one of those government operations.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know. Ruled it a suicide.
Yeah, suicide. Know? He shot himself 3 times.
Right.
Crazy.
Yeah. So
two of them were kill shots.
I don't know if that's an April Fool's joke or anything
sure.
like that. I have no idea.
Okay.
But you know what's April Fool's is this guy RFK Jr.
Sure. Yeah.
One
yeah.
of the unhealthiest people I've ever seen in my life.
Right, in charge of the Department of Health.
And he looks like one of those old California raisin guys.
Yes,
from
he does.
The 80s, doesn't
right,
he?
Right.
And he speaks like, I don't know what the hell he speaks. But he's telling people, you know, he's taking away all these vaccinations and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I found out this is part of his whole program. You know how people change their toothbrush, they change their car oil, or their AC filter.
Mm-hmm.
He's demanding that Americans change their toilet seat every 3 months.
Wow.
Have you heard about this?
Seems excessive.
Yeah, every 3 months he's saying we got to change our toilet seats.
Huh.
You know?
He must have stock in a toilet seat company.
Okay.
I have no idea.
I never heard of
this.
I
don't know. It seems all right, maybe. How often do you change? I do it at least once every 3 years, I think I do mine. Have you ever changed your toilet seat?
I mean, I have. Sometimes they'll break, you know.
I change it every about 3 years.
Huh.
Yeah, it's just to be safe.
Well, you know, they say that, like, the toilet seat's actually, like, if they go and they do, like, a swab, like, your cutting board at in your kitchen has more germs than the toilet seat.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I like to put I have those in my bathroom, those little liners. Yeah, you put over your toilet seat.
Oh, really?
Seat. Yeah. That's why I can wait 3 years.
Like at the airport?
Yeah, the airport or, public places. I have those liners that you put, like,
but it's just
kind of waxy kind of thing.
You like those?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's just you and your wife, though. I mean, I don't know.
Well, she doesn't know where I've been, and I don't know where she's
been.
Do you remember in the 70s when they had the padded seats?
Yeah.
The vinyl.
Those are weird.
Seats,
those
right?
are weird.
Right, they were weird.
Yeah.
Well, what about the some people it was in vogue to have like a wooden toilet seat. You ever remember that? The wooden toilet seats?
Oh, yeah. That was
for style, not comfort.
Yeah.
But also, I think I've seen like a fur toilet seat, which seems like a terrible idea. I mean,
I think Elvis had that in the Graceland.
Yep. Yeah.
The jungle room.
Lavender fur.
Yeah.
I remember I had a fur sink.
Okay.
Once,
wow.
That didn't work out.
Yeah.
That didn't work
that
out.
That seems like an April Fool's joke.
It was purple fur.
Okay. Right.
Oh, there was something growing in your sink.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
Could be. Could be. Maybe some Lysol.
I think
it was something growing.
Yeah.
All right.
So,
well, anything else, Manny?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've got tons of stuff here.
Right.
That guy, Hegseth, you hear about him again? You know, he's always in the news.
Sure.
He's our leader of, what is he, the Defense Department?
Yeah.
Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, well, I heard this, that he wants to have steep cuts in the number of steps it takes to recovery.
Okay, like cut it down from 12?
Yeah.
Like maybe
he wants to cut it in half, the steps to recovery.
Okay.
I don't know, you know, the 9th step is always the hardest for people, I guess. I guess that's the one he wants to get out.
Which one is that? Making amends?
Yeah, it's the one who apologized to people.
Right, well, that's the one all of our friends leave out. You know, when they have to pay you the money that they stole from you, they forget that step.
Yeah, so he's trying to get that. It's going to go to the Senate or to the Congress, and I don't know what's going on.
Huh, okay.
Isn't he a purported alcoholic?
Yeah.
Well, that's why he wants to cut down on
to make it more efficient.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So just like one. I surrender, I guess, is
just
the one.
Admit you have a problem and move on.
You have a problem and move on and make it someone else's problem.
Sure, sure.
You know? But he seems like a good guy.
Okay, I don't know. Jerry's still out.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see about him.
Again, I'm still.
I love his tattoos.
Still trying to. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the white nationalist tattoos are quite inspiring. Yeah, it's. I think most of our guests that wind up here, maybe it's an age thing, but don't have any tattoos. I know I don't. I don't think Manny has any. I'm guessing you don't have any. I'm guessing you don't either. All right, four out of four.
I had an opportunity to get one when I lived in Los Angeles.
Well, yeah, we all have opportunities.
And it was going to be a surprise.
To you?
My wife at that time said, "We're going out tonight. We're going out, but you got to put on a blindfold." I said, "Okay." So she's driving me around L.A. and she drives me up. I don't know where it was. We're just driving here, driving there, and she stops and she says, "Okay, I'm coming to get you out of the car." She takes me out of the car and leads me up the stairs at some place, and I hear the door open and the bell dingle on the door, and it closes, and she takes the blindfold off and goes, "Surprise!" And sitting in front of me was a tattoo artist with the needle ready to work on me.
Oh, jeez.
Was there a design already planned?
Yeah, I kept talking, you know, because I'm half Sicilian, so I was talking about having an olive with a pimento on my arm for a number of years. And it just goes to show my wife at that time was listening to me.
All right.
But anyway.
But you dodged that bullet. You decided it was not the time.
I just said to her, "Can we talk outside for a minute, please?"
Okay.
I got in the car and I said, "Sorry, no way."
Right, right, right.
Chickened out.
Right, right. Well, anyway, that Hexeth, he's covered in them.
Well, that's annoying. I see. The thing is, I've had plenty of opportunity to have tats and stuff, but I just don't know what I'd want there for the long, you know, for my lifetime. I just could never, I don't know what I'd put there.
Right. Well,
you know,
someone compared getting a tattoo.
I mean, some of them, I see tattoos on some people. I go, "Wow, that is," and I have to tell them how cool the tattoo is.
I mean,
some of them I see on some women. I said they're just absolutely beautiful stuff. I mean, the work is, it's beautiful. Tattoo artists are really that artist.
Sure.
And they do some beautiful work.
I heard someone compare it to if you liked platform shoes so much in the 70s, you had them nailed to your feet. that's what getting a tattoo is like.
I actually had a pair of platform shoes.
I'll never not want to wear these.
I had a pair. They were two-tone, green and red.
Aren't you sorry you didn't have them stapled to your feet permanently?
Oh, I'm kind of glad
didn't
I didn't,
Pete
actually.
Davidson just have all his tattoos
all
removed?
Burned off, yeah.
Yeah, and wasn't it like excruciating
No,
Wait, who was that?
I've known Pete Davidson.
I've known people to have
young
their,
comedian guy
tattoos removed, and it's more painful than the tattoo.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I think he's into all that pain, that guy.
Who, Hexeth?
No.
Oh, Pete Davidson.
Of course he is. Didn't he date Kardashian?
He did a Kardashian.
So he's in the pain.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right. And, you know, his father died at 9/11.
Yeah, he was a firefighter.
Fireman.
Oh, man.
So there's deep regret. But one of his funniest bits I've ever seen him do, and this is, you know, pain, I guess, but is that he's, you know, he said, you know, my dad died in 9/11. That was like 8 years ago, whatever, whenever I saw this bit. He goes, "And I'm really trying to get my mom laid. She needs to get fucked badly. Who out there will fuck my mom?" He did a whole 10 minutes about someone fucking his mom.
Nah.
And it was the funniest thing. And then the next act, I forget what the comedian's name was. His first line was, "I'll fuck your mom, Pete."
He wins.
Oh, God. Forget that guy. Fuck, what's his name? Anyway, yeah. Shout out to Pete Day.
Right on. He's a good guy.
You know, to me, he doesn't seem like the most attractive of a man, but he gets chicks, man.
Chicks
that
digging,
guy
man. Yeah,
gets
chicks
the
digging.
Women, man. Kind of like me.
Yeah. Sure,
kinda like
sure.
me, because
yeah.
chicks
I,
dig me.
Yeah, right, right.
You
know? They dig
it. So, but good, more power to him.
Right on. Yeah.
But it's interesting. I mean, I'm just thinking, Darren, we both played in what you could call at the beginning of our career in music was punk bands.
Yeah.
And as a punk band, you know, you'd think the first thing you'd do is go out and get a tattoo.
Right, yeah.
It's a different era.
Anybody else in your band had tattoos?
No, John got one when he was Under the Influence, but it's really small. It's a red star. That's it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The only other one.
Yeah, Rick, our lead singer, got one.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just certain cats who are, you know, or have that feeling that they want tattoos. I mean, I grew up with tons of cats in the late 70s and 80s who are all in bands and stuff, and some of them had tats and a lot of tats, and some of them just didn't bother, you know?
Right.
I don't know. No. I mean, I guess it's a way, for a lot of people I knew back then, it was a way for them to not to spend their money on that than on dope and stuff like that. You know, it's like because they want that feeling, you know, that feeling.
Endorphin rush.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And, you know, and that, I guess you could get addicted to it. Getting tats.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I'm
you
sure
can get addicted to it.
Yeah.
You know, you see these people with, you know, fucking tattoos on their face.
Yeah. Right. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. It's too far. It's too far.
On their necks and on their throats.
Mike Ness from Social Distortion.
Yeah.
Yeah. That guy's nuts about the tats. Yeah. Yeah.
Social Distortion.
Social D. Yeah. Mike Ness.
You can't even wear a shirt anymore. Well, with a collar. You know, tattoos that look like something growing out of the back of your neck, you know?
we're sounding old now, Ollie.
I know, but you know, hey, look, more. Look, it's whatever anybody wants to
sure,
do to
yeah,
their
yeah.
neck.
More power
that's
to them.
Fine, you know? But, you know, look, tattoos, I think, are on. Like I said, I think some of them are really beautiful to look at, interesting to look at. But I don't know, man. Marking up your neck and your throat is, you know, I don't know.
All right.
That's like prison stuff.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I managed a rockabilly band, and the singer was Jewish, and he had full sleeves. Oh. And whenever he went to go visit his parents, he had
to cover them all up.
They lived in Connecticut. It was probably like 101 degrees there and humid. Full long button down, long sleeve shirt.
All right, well, at least he still had a sense of shame. He wanted to hide it from his parents. I appreciate that. You know, shouldn't have done it in the first place.
See, when I did
whatever.
That, when I'd visit my parents, they said, "Are you shooting up still?"
Right, right. Yeah. if you don't have short sleeves on, yeah. I think it's because of track marks.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. My dad was a pharmacist by profession.
Oh.
And
is he still around?
No, he wasn't, no, but
man, he wanted to get his number.
He knew he worked for did a sideline job, unbeknownst to most of us at the time, for the DEA.
Oh, okay.
Because they needed somebody to mix the drug that heroin addicts take to get off of them.
The methadone.
Methadone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Liquid handcuffs, they call it.
They had a huge safe in the back of that, and we had a back room built for us to play music in, and there was a huge safe back there. I mean, it was like a 6-foot safe. And we said, "Hey, Pop, what is that?" "Oh, that's not. I'm just keeping all our records in there and everything." But that's where they kept the dope.
Oh, okay, methadone.
And the DEA agents would come over every now and then. These guys would show up.
This is back in the 70s.
My dad was have to get up, go to the back and say, "Okay, you kid, y'all can't come back here right now. I have some business to discuss." And he was mixing methadone for heroin addicts.
Okay.
Well, that was a big program for the Nixon administration. The Nixon administration started the methadone program.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that Nixon tried to do is get junkies off the street.
Yeah.
You know. And more whores. He wanted whores than junkies.
Well, it keeps everybody's TV safe.
Yeah,
that's
anyway.
The thing that methadone does. You know, you're still on drugs, but at least you know you're.
Well, I always thought you know you're gonna
people
steal
won't break into your house.
Yeah, but at that time, I remember in the 70s, early 80s, I knew people who would steal TVs, but they were no good because they forgot to steal the remote.
Oh shoot!
So it was no good.
Right.
You know. Anyway.
Yeah, can we get to our guests here? We're going long in this front half here, and we got two guests.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Let's right. get to the
I didn't know if you wanted us to start talking or not. I was kind of waiting
for
well,
good. No,
some
no,
sort
you're
of
good.
An introduction.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
The introduction is coming
it's like
now.
Like people hear it as they go,
right.
Don't worry about it, man.
No, they'll be able to, your name will be in the title. They'll be able to puzzle it all out.
Yeah.
Well, so we have it's a very special night. We have two guests. We have a returning guest. He's a founding bassist in the legendary New Orleans punk group, the Red Rockers. formerly the Rat Finks in their first incarnation. He's also been affiliated with groups like the Rain Dogs, Paul Westerberg. He's a founder of Ten Pin Artist Management. He's been the manager of Replacements, New York Dolls, all kind of other bands, Rocky Erickson, Royal Crowns, Combustible Edison, and he's a proprietor of his own Pop Emporium in Providence, Rhode Island, a great antique and performance shop gallery, and he's back in town for the second annual, or second anyway, hopefully annual, New Orleans punk rock family reunion with his band, the Red Rockers, as well as a terrific foundational punk rock band in New Orleans, the Contenders. Hasn't played in 40 years. I think they're reforming to open the show. And Lenny Zenith is also on the bill. Big show at Tipitina's. And he brought in as his special guest a fantastic cinematographer, director, producer, writer, actor. His work includes Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken, Xena the Warrior Princess, Silk Stockings, the controversial 1994 Roger Corman production of The Fantastic Four. But most importantly, he's the director of the Red Rockers hit MTV video for their 1983 hit single, China. And besides that, he was also a guitarist with another foundational New Orleans punk era band, Sex Dog, which had members Dave Clements of Czar of the Klempire, as well as his brother Cranston Clements, also the great Scott Gudo on guitar, also the dearly departed Nicky Sonsenbach, who we had on the program a couple of months before he passed away, and also Rick Wigington as their singer. Anyway, so
and our final drummer Dave Landry,
okay,
who passed away.
Oh, so sorry. Yeah. But
Do you think he could still do the show though?
Without further ado, we have Darren Hill from the Red Rockers, original founding bass player with the Red Rockers, and the great Ole Sassone. Welcome, Darren and Ole.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, yeah. Great to
honored
have y'all
to
here.
Be back.
I was really happy that Darren called me out of the blue to ask me if I wanted to do a podcast. And I said, absolutely.
Okay.
I just, because I just felt, because of the invitation and for Darren and the respect I have for him and the band, the Red Rockers, and I heard you guys were going to be here. I just had to do this.
The night is young, my friend. You might lose some of it tonight.
Well, you know, Ole, like in show business in general, you know, the people that say yes, that's the people that wind up succeeding. People that say no to things, they stay on their sofa, nothing ever happens for them, right?
Good point.
Okay. So.
No, that's a good point.
You know, no, I'm just saying.
I saw a lot of those people when I was in L.A. for 20-some odd years.
Right? Yeah.
I had so many girlfriends that I said, come on, say yes to this, and they never did.
And where are they now? not married to Manny Chevrolet.
Well, so, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not in the business, and you know what kind of business I'm talking
about.
Okay,
right.
You know what I'm saying?
That business.
You know.
Well, Darren, you were on an earlier show, maybe like November of 2023.
Yes.
Right. And that was right around the time that the Red Rockers did the first one where you performed the entirety of, was that Condition Red?
Condition Red.
Right. And this time around, you guys are performing your second record.
Yes, Good as Gold, our major label debut.
Okay.
And case in point, bringing Ole on board.
Right. So, so anybody that wants to go back and hear the deep dive on Darren, you know, can go back to that one. It has his name in the title, Darren Hill. I think it has Red Rockers Revisited or something like that. Something in the title.
Did you see on, I made this big deal out of it because Spotify had me listed as the writer for China, but they put me as Daryl Hall. I shit you not. And it took a year to get it changed.
Was Daryl Hall getting your publishing?
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
Like he needs it. You know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe if you could get some of his, if you get some of his.
I said I'd gladly trade.
Trade, yeah, yeah. Sure.
Now, is China on condition red or was on the first
No, it's
record?
On good as gold. So that was our big breakthrough.
So will you do China this Saturday?
Oh, yes, we will.
Yeah, well, that's yeah. China's
yes, we doing
from
every
this,
song
this
off that,
that
record,
performing.
Yeah.
Well, I just no. You just yeah. said it wasn't.
No, so no.
So it is.
Condition Red was the first LP that they performed in its entirety.
That was
last
year and a half ago.
And that was China was on that.
No,
no.
China.
So you
is
didn't
on
perform China last time.
We did, but we did a messed up version of it just to like
just kind of as
some people
yeah. as an extra.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's
it was
cool.
A great song. But how many songs on that album? Good as Gold.
11.
11. Cool.
Well, so let's go back. Oli, you know, you are from New Orleans, right?
Right.
You grew up here. What just to give people background, what high school did you go to? What neighborhood did you grow up in?
Metairie.
Okay.
I went to Rummel High School.
I was going
to
guess that. Archbishop Rummel.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Look, at the time, we hated
where
it.
Where rape is a major, right?
Yeah, all boys. It was all boys.
Yeah.
You know, Christian Brothers. But, you know, sometimes I look back and I say, you know, it's a good thing I went someplace where they beat the shit out of you when you were bad. Because we were bad.
You needed
and
it,
I,
you're saying.
And I think, you know, we needed discipline.
Needed a good beating.
I mean, I was, you know, I was too skinny and they didn't really beat on me. My older brother was, he played football and they wouldn't beat on him because he would have knocked the shit out of them.
All right.
But, you know, look.
And these are the priests, the instructors.
But at that time, this is when the movie Easy Rider came out. So we were radical. And I'll try to make this story quick. But another friend named Arthur Brands and I, there was a big assembly in the student assembly in the gym. The entire student body in the gym. And we stopped on the way into the gym. We ducked into the men's bathroom. He put on a pair of stars and stripes bell bottoms, and I put on a blue jean jacket with the American flag on the back.
Oh, just like Easy Rider, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Dude. And the whole student assembly, the body, everybody's in there, and they're just getting started, and it was gotten quiet, and it was in the gym, and we crashed the doors open and make a big entrance. And the whole place just went wild, erupted. And here we were, man.
And then they all beat the shit out of you. The whole assembly just ganged up.
No, the Christian, not the students, man.
Oh, okay.
The Christian brothers came after us, man, and we just knew we were going to get our asses kicked. But we didn't care. Because you know they were honest about how long our hair was, and your hair's touching the collar of your shirt, you got to cut it. And people have to realize that. And the point of the story is, I guess, in a sense, if you look at what's happening in this country today, you start pushing people too hard, they're going to fight back.
Okay. All right.
You know? And that's what we did.
Okay.
Like our last election this past weekend.
You know?
Where those amendments that our governor thought would just go right through.
They all failed.
They all failed because parishes all over the state where he won, they said, fuck no, man.
Yep. Yeah,
right.
I got to give
power
a little
to
credit.
The people.
Give
man.
A little credit to Mick Jagger.
Yeah, Mick Jagger.
He put Governor Landry down big time.
I heard that. That was great.
I was there, brother. It was so good.
I was there too.
Yeah.
Well, so at this time in high school, were you already playing music? Were you in bands and stuff?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Playing guitars and actually doing both things. Playing music and making Super 8 movies.
So is that how you got, your family had a Super 8 camera and you just start fucking around
there
with
was
it?
A, there was a teacher in our school who was a photographer and a filmmaker. And he showed us his pictures when he was, before he came to Rummel. And he was a hippie.
Okay.
But, you know, he came to Rummel to teach, you know, the arts and photography and so on and so forth. And he had to cut his hair and look. But we looked at this guy, and he said, damn, that's you, brother? He goes, yeah. And then he, so we just like, you know, we went to hang out with the guy we thought was the coolest guy in the faculty.
Right on.
And he had this really cool Super 8 camera where you could literally focus the lens.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like something you just go pick up
point
and automatically
shoot.
This was like a real movie camera.
What was his name? You want to give him a shout out?
Oh, damn. I wish.
Can't remember. All right. Well,
Martin Scorsese? No.
Could be.
Yeah, could have been. I wish. No, but that's how it all started.
Ernie went to Rummel. Okay.
But yeah, the whole time. Yeah, who went to Rummel?
Marty. Scorsese. All
right. Yeah. He like, well, he was Catholic boy, so
yeah.
Italian
was,
Catholic like me. But
right.
Anyway, so that's how that started. And then we started making Super 8 films. And, you know, I'd go on vacation with my parents, like to Pensacola, Florida, and I make beach blanket bingo type movies at Super 8, you know?
Yeah, I had
always
a Super
playing
8.
Music, you know? I started playing music before I got interested in shooting film. But and it was really because of A Hard Day's Night. You know, and I was a kid, went to see A Hard Day's Night, and I mean, first of all, it was the Beatles, but secondly, the theater was filled with screaming girls, and I said, oh my God, I got to do something like that
to
so
make
I can
girl
get
scream.
Girls screaming for me.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a movie still today is like a, it's compared to like French New Wave movies and the handheld, the style of the whole movie, black and white, you know, it was just beautifully done.
Who directed that film?
Richard
again?
Lester.
Yeah, Richard Lester.
He's an American.
Yes.
He wasn't a Brit.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, and then to this day, the film is they're still running on TCM and make and the people that talk about it,
it holds
they
up.
They talk about it as the French New Wave, you know, and you know, like the movies of Godard, you know, like Breathless and those kind of films.
Right, right. So you were in Sex Dog. So I'd known Cranston since I'm a little kid. He played in my father's band as a guitar player, and so did Scott Gudo. Also, when you know he'd wind up taking over the chair for Cranston's going off and doing something else. And so then when Cranston says, "Oh, we have a punk rock band," I was like, "Really?" Because I was into the Pistols and stuff, and you know already hearing that music, and so. And then he said, well, we have a gig at Luigi's. So, and as far as I know, that might be your first public gig. That's how I always think of it. And I was at that gig.
Wow.
And
we have a tape of that gig.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So, I know Cranston does.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, so
Luigi's is down by UNO.
Yeah, up by the lakefront. Right. So I was at that gig. So at that time, were you already doing commercial film work?
We were shooting. I was shooting TV commercials for Louisiana Power and Light. We were doing political commercials. I'd shot some commercials for the governor of Louisiana.
Do you have your own production company or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I worked for other production companies too when I was just starting in the business. You know, I started assistant cameraman, and then I got into the cameraman's union as an assistant cameraman, and I worked on Pretty Baby that they shot here, and I became an assistant to Sven Nykvist, and then Sven, and in case people out there don't know, Sven Nykvist shot all the Ingmar Bergman movies,
right?
Academy Award for Cries and Whispers and so on and so forth at the Swedish Film Institute, And he asked me to start. He called me in his office. He said, in fact, the first time he called me, I thought it was somebody playing a joke.
Yeah.
He said, oh, hello, Oli, this is Sven Nykvist. And I said, really? He said, yes, I want you to come see me at the Pontchartrain Hotel. And I went, really? He said, yes, I want you to come shoot the film for me. And I said, hey, Ricky, go fuck yourself. Because he knew I was trying to get a gig on a movie.
Uh-huh.
And luckily, Sven Nykvist called me back. He called me back and said, hello, Oli, don't hang up, really. This is Sven Nykvist. And I went, oh. So sure enough, he hired me to come over and shoot a film behind the scenes of the making of Pretty Baby. Ah. And the reason he did that is to bring his surviving son back over from Stockholm, because his other son, right before the movie started, or right after the movie started, his other son had committed suicide.
Oh, man.
So he brought Charlie Nykvist back, and Paramount Pictures paid for that. And anyway, they needed somebody to shoot it, so they hired me to shoot it. So I went to Sweden that summer and hung out with them and went to the Swedish Film Institute, where they were making movies with all these great Ingmar Bergman, you know, ensemble cast members. Wow. But the one thing that they really loved when they were in New Orleans, they loved listening to WYLD.
Okay.
WYLD, you know, the black radio
station. Sure, yeah, yeah.
And back then, that station was locally owned. It wasn't owned by some big conglomerate someplace. So therefore, the commercials and things that they ran on WYLD were all these really cool homegrown commercials.
Right, right.
You know, and they would whack them out with reverb and and all kind of crazy stuff in these commercials. So before I went over to Stockholm, I recorded 4 hours straight across of WYLD, and I brought it to him, and I said, "Here, man, there's WYLD on this cassette tapes." With all these wacky commercials
right
in between the really cool New Orleans music.
Yeah.
So they're listening to this, and I go, "Oh, Oli, we have to get the voice of like this for the opening of our film." This is the behind the scenes movie for Pretty Baby. And I said, "Yeah, great. That's a really good idea." And they looked at me and I said, "You're going to do it."
He said,
"What do you mean I'm going to do it?" He said, "Yeah, you got to do it." So we go into the screening room of frickin' Ingmar Bergman's personal screening room, where he just finished doing a movie called The Serpent's Egg, and I'm sitting on there with a microphone and a little script that I made up, and they said, "Okay, Oli, let's do it." And I go, "Hey, y'all, where you at? It's 83 degrees in the breeze, baby, down there in Knowledge. Boy, you better take that shirt off. It's hot as shit out there now." You know, and I did this whole black thing for the movie. For the opening of the film.
Uh-huh.
And I even said, WYLDDDDDDD, you know? And sure enough, that my voice opens the movie.
Oh, okay.
Well, the documentary.
The documentary, yeah, the right, not pretty yeah. baby,
right, yeah, right,
yeah, obviously. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, that was a trip. So, you know, that's what sort of snowballed, you know, my career started to snowball, and I started doing directing jobs and so on and so forth. And,
okay.
But always keeping music in the mix.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I don't know.
It was a very fertile time in the New Orleans rock and roll scene. It had
Hell
bands
yeah.
exploding. And, you know, like when you say punk rock, people always think of like the jackhammering eighth notes. But, you know, that's punk rock was way broader palette than that. It had all kind of different bands playing different kind of variations on weird style. And certainly Sex Dog was, you know, it had a lot of Zappa damage in there, you know, and a lot of weirdness that was thrown in along with all the heavy guitars and everything. So,
but I'm guessing, you know, they're the same way. We love New Orleans music.
Sure.
I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, the Meters, you know, the Neville Brothers, the Wild Chapatoulas, you know.
Right.
I mean, and not just those guys who were high profile. I mean, I used to go to a place called the Glass House.
Oh, sure.
You remember the Glass House?
Yeah, Glass House was a Dirty Dozen brass band's home club. Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
it. And
Central
I saw,
City.
You know, I was talking to, and I guess I can mention his name, Wynton Marsalis.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Because my wife was the executive director of the NOCA Foundation.
Oh, okay.
For 25 years. So she knew all the people, all these great musicians and people who went to NOCA. So, you know, we're in New York, you know, we went to see Wynton, and we went out to dinner afterwards, and we're sitting with Wynton, and, you know, we're talking about stuff and talking about New Orleans. And you know, he's just looking at me, and then I don't know how the conversation got to that, but I said, "Oh yeah, man, you know, yeah, like yeah, the Glass House." And he says, and he looked at me because he said, "What do you know about the Glass House, man?" I said, "Well, we used to go there, and because it was off the path, man."
Sure, you know? Yeah, yeah.
And we'd go there and listen to the Dirty Dozen, and it was like me and maybe two other white people in the whole club, you know. But it was cool.
Right. Because nobody gave you a hard time. Yeah, it was cool. Yeah, yeah.
Just dug the music.
Right.
You know, and then we'd do these, we'd go on Chapatoulas, and where they do like the Mardi Gras Indians would come out and do their ritual dance before Mardi Gras.
Right.
And the ritual dance back in the old days was they'd really go after each other and beat each other up with bats and clubs, and some of them would bring axes and shit. But we'd go to this and go watch the ritual dances of the Mardi Gras Indians.
Why did they get rid of that? See, I would go out for Mardi Gras to see that.
Cut the population down,
yeah,
I guess.
But I would go see that.
But
I
man, don't. But that was also, it was very tribal. The music was intense. the whole thing was really intense, you know, where they would just do these moves and dances so like that.
A
like,
real battle of the bands.
Like, right, yeah, right, right. But there was a battle of...
It was battle, literal, like, violent.
It was all symbolic.
Literally a battle of the bands.
But the tambourines
I'm
and
gonna
the music
kill you.
And the rhythms Jesus. And the drums and everything were just... I mean, all that stuff was very influential when you grow up in New Orleans and you want to pick up on the music and as a bass player, especially, Darren, I would think, you know, bass players, you know, that's the rhythm, man.
Sure,
you guys,
sure.
You guys keep the bottom going, man. That's just stuff. It's in your blood, you know?
Right. You know, this time is flying by, Ole. You see, I told you, like, are we going to have enough stuff to talk about? Holy cow.
Well, it's your fault, man.
Holy cow.
holy cow. It's about that time. Looking at our drinks. Yeah. It's, Manny, tell the people.
Yeah, we need to take a break. We'll be right back.
With Mr. Manny Chevrolet.
Yes.
I am Renee Coleman.
You are.
Back with our guests, Mr. Darren Hill and Mr. Ole Sassone. Now, I know, Darren, you're familiar with the podcast, Ole less so, but Ole, I will tell you that this is a listener-supported operation. We don't have any corporate sponsorship. Not that we would refuse it, but, you know, hasn't happened for us so far. But we do have a PayPal link and a Venmo link, and we have devoted listeners who contribute to those to the podcast through those links. They buy us rounds of cocktails, underwrite our operating costs, the hosting podcast hosting costs. You can see we use a lot of notebooks. It's a very analog operation here. We do thank you, everyone who's doing that, and have a shout out to a couple of people. Last week's guest, a couple of weeks ago, Tony Toko.
Oh,
very generous support. Also, we have the Patreon link there. We have a handful of patrons that are supporting us week in, week out. Also, we have the Trouble Men podcast T-shirts, and we have a link there where you can purchase those for you and your family, loved ones, neighbors. And we had somebody bought a T-shirt this week, Charles. I'm not sure what Charles's last name is, but I know what size he wears. But I won't divulge that on the podcast. It's nobody's business but your own. And you know, if you want to jump in on those T-shirts, once that campaign, once somebody buys one, it's the window's open for you. You can get one much quicker. So if you were just waiting. Your time. The time is now. Time to strike while the iron's hot, right, Darren?
Right.
Also, let's see. Follow us on social media: Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us a lot. Cost you nothing. I have a slew of French Quarter Fest gigs coming up. Go to the Renee Coleman Facebook page, yeah, and you can see all my lists will be there. Well, you know, it's, sure, you know, so, it's my vocation.
It's a free gig. It's not like they have to pay to it, you know.
No,
he's a busy man, though.
I would like to see people show up. You know, I have a whole more than one handful of artists I'm playing with at French Quarter Fest. So you can check those out on the links to the Renee Coman Facebook page or in the podcast as well. And here, sometimes I forget, but let me have the presentation of the Troublemen podcast stickers to both of our guests. Oli.
Thank you.
So one to stick and one to save, or you can stick them both.
Cool.
We have one of these up at the entrance to Pop.
Nice. Yeah. I love it. Thank you. We appreciate that. Cool.
Don't put it on your bumper because you'll get pulled over.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And if your papers aren't in order, it could be tough. You could be on your way to El Salvadoran prison somewhere, whether you deserve it or not.
I know we're laughing, man, but it's really horrible.
Laughing to keep from crying.
It's horrible what they're doing, but.
Back to our guests, Mr. Darren Hill from the Red Rockers and Mr. Oli Sassone. Now, Oli, you were talking about your film career, and I remember when I was still at Ben Franklin and walking next door, and you were directing a commercial right there on Carrollton Avenue, right next, like in front of the Burger King or something there.
Probably a commercial for Burger King.
It might have been, but I remember saying, oh, look at Oli, he's got a big giant production. And
yeah, it was a Burger King commercial.
He's legit, man. Yeah. And so that must have been like 1981, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So at the same time, Red Rockers are, their career is taking off. You had the first record, which was very successful. Put you out on the road with a lot of big international and national acts. And then the second record comes out, and I guess they had the company had one idea of like what the cover was going to be, and then they picked a single. Now, how did Oli wind up directing that China video?
Well, Darren, can I just ask him a question?
Yeah.
Do the setup though on how you guys got signed and how it became a record, if you don't mind, because you guys took off. You guys went to the West Coast,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think we probably covered this in the last podcast.
But you can, but
yeah,
oh,
we,
okay.
We,
can we just do a little quick recap?
We had
Thank
to
you.
Leave New Orleans. If we had any hopes of making it. So, yeah, we packed everything we owned in a truck and moved out to California, and we weren't coming back till we had a record deal. And we did it. We got it. And
you did it, indeed.
415 Records?
Yeah, it was 415, and then through them, Columbia Records signed us. And, they had high hopes for us. They really loved the record, and they probably spent our whole budget on Annie Leibovitz taking our album cover photos. So
that's pretty big time, though, brother.
I think, MTV was just coming up, and they wanted us to make a video, but they probably blew their budget. So luckily, Oli stepped up, and you want to take over from here and tell them, like, what happened?
Well, I don't mind hearing your perspective of it, but I don't remember who it was exactly, you or John or James. I mean, all of a sudden I was holding the album. You guys had already recorded the album,
yeah,
right? And I'm looking at it and I'm going, wow, man, and I don't even know how it came up, but maybe I said, you guys doing a video? I said, yeah, why don't we do it? We can do it. And I kind of felt like it was like a Andy Hardy movie or something,
Like, let's put on a show.
Put on a show.
Exactly.
we didn't have any money.
Well, at that time, if you think about MTV, they were starved for content. There was not a ton of videos in existence then. So
absolutely.
If you had one, you had a leg up in getting played. And if you had a good one with a great song, you really had a good shot. You really had a good shot. So they had the great song, and then you talk
well,
about
always. And I used to say this always because I've directed probably over 100 music videos in my career. But I always used to say, good videos come from great songs.
Okay.
And China was a great song,
right?
And you just the imagery just starts to flow when you hear a really good song. I mean, it inspires you, frankly, and it did. And luckily for me, I knew these guys because they would open for us as the Rat Finks. We were Sex Dog at Jed's. And You guys weren't even old enough to get into a bar.
No, you guys were like our big brothers. We used to joke about that.
We did this video for absolutely no money from the record company because I called them to tell them I wanted to do the video, and I talked to somebody at CBS, I don't recall. They said, yeah, well, fine, you know, but if you can do whatever the hell you want, we're not giving you any money for it, and you only have, you know, X amount of time, I don't remember what it was, a month or 2 months or so to get something done. And that's how it started. So I just laid out my credit card and borrowed money from a guy who ran Mushroom Records at Tulane.
All right.
And we did it.
So it was all on spec, essentially.
Totally on spec. Yeah. And I called the lady up at CBS. You can jump anytime.
I think her name was Shelley Sellover. Yeah, she was head of it. She was like the publicist out of Spinal Tap.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah, but she was put in charge of...
As I recall, she had a New York accent.
Yes, she was very New York.
Very New Yorker. She was on the phone. I said, when I called her, I said, okay, we got a video done. And she was like, silence. And she said, I'm going to come down there, and I'm going to sit down, and you're going to show me a video. And you got a video? I said, yeah, we got a video. We did it. All right, I'm coming down there. You better have something for me to look at, because there was no way at that time to even send stuff
a file
back and
right,
forth.
Right, right.
We shot it on 16 millimeter film. There was no internet. There was none of that. So sure enough, we got the thing set up at WYS, the public television station here, with my friend Dave Landry, who was our drummer.
Right.
And we set the thing up on the flatbed machine. She comes marching in. She doesn't say boo. She just said, okay, where am I going? And she just, you know, typical, you know, executive type, you know, not going to be nice to us until she sees the product, you know. So she sits down, we hit play, and we're all standing behind her. There it is on the screen on a flatbed, and she's just watching it. And this is before we could even do any of the video effects.
Mm-hmm.
And we turn it off, and she sits there for a second. She goes, I'm buying it.
Oh, nice. Oh, nice, wow. Nice.
I'm buying it.
Well, I like someone to make a decision. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I just want to say that started and launched my film career right there. And then that was the pivotal moment of my career. Nice. Right there.
Nice.
Wow.
Because CBS called me and my production company in New Orleans and started sending us out to where the bands were on the road.
Okay.
And we were doing, and then we went out to, they had me go out to L.A., and I'd never really been out there, so we go to Los Angeles on their dime, even though it wasn't a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, it was the Romantics.
Oh, okay.
And I was doing commercials here locally for an ad agency here called Fitzgerald, and the guy at Fitzgerald, Joe Del Papa, one of my best friends ever. He was a beautiful guy. He was a brilliant guy. He said, well, when you go out to L.A., you got to call this production company that I work with called Filmfare. They're out there. They do, and it was a big commercial production company. Mm-hmm. They had offices in L.A., Chicago, London, you know, Paris. I mean, it was huge. So I called them, said, Joe Del Papa said to come. And he said, okay. They send a rep over to the set while we're shooting the Romantics video. He says nothing. He just, I'll just sit over here. I'm okay. You want some water? I said, no, I'm fine. Just go ahead. Go do your job. I'm going to sit here and watch. And he said nothing. And he's there for like 20, 30 minutes. And then he gets up to leave. He comes over. He says, here, just call us before you leave L.A. And I called, and that was it. And I called the dude. And I said, okay, you know, go over there. And they said, right, I mean, I'm sitting down for like 10 minutes. Introduce me. They're bringing me water, Coke, whatever I want. You know, and they, you know, like a special guest or something. I said, yeah. They said, how would you like to move to Los Angeles? I said, well, I don't know. I never thought about it. He said, well, I'll tell you what. You know, it's kind of like, because I was naive about it, maybe they thought I was playing hard to get.
Okay.
But I really just didn't know. I said, no, I don't know. I might, you know. And they were like, well, how about we pay you to move to L.A.?
You have to sweeten the pot for you. Yeah.
I said, oh, okay, you pay. Yeah, that's okay. That sounds pretty good. How's $2,500 sound? I said, yeah, that'll cover it. Okay. And I'm not showing too much excitement.
All right.
And they said, well, and I'm just kind of quietly sitting there, you know, and they said, well, tell you what. And they go and talk, and then they come back. We'll pay you, we'll put you on a retainer. We'll pay you $4,000 a month whether you work or not.
Okay.
Oh, sweet.
I said, okay, well, I'm moving to, I guess I'm moving to L.A.
And that's when the drug habit started?
Yeah. And that's when it all started. Everything was downhill from
now,
there, man.
Now, the romantics, was that when you're talking in your sleep? Was that the video?
No, it was, okay. It was called One in a Million.
Oh, that one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all
that
right.
one.
I remember that band. That was a band that had the drummer was the singer, right?
Isn't that what I like about you? The romantics, what I like about you?
Yeah, that's what I like about you.
Now, you said that great song makes a great video. I don't agree. I've seen many great songs with really bad videos.
Well, I'm just talking about personally because I haven't made great videos either, man, because some of the songs were shit. But,
well, no,
but
some
I
of the
did
songs
make,
are great, but the videos were just awful.
But other than the Red Rockers, China, I did Broken Wings for Mr. Mister.
Okay.
That black and white video, and that turned out to be an award nominated award. Once again, the song, man, you know, inspiration, you know, Darren, you get inspiration from wherever you can get it. You get it, and you take it, you know.
Now, I remember the China video. The most memorable part to me is the beautiful John Thomas Griffith. He's kind of coming down and we were looking at a video of the making of China today, and you see John there and this fresh-faced young handsome form.
We were
all
young.
We were all young, yeah. We were all a lot prettier then. But he's kind of coming down a market scene, and he's kind of doing the new wave dance from side to side, you know.
Pirate's Alley.
Pirate's Alley, yeah.
French Quarter,
yeah.
Man.
Into China.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So it's I could remember it like it's yesterday, man. It's and that was there was so little content on MTV, or I mean maybe it's just because this was super popular, but it played like on repeat.
Yeah, because again, like you said, they didn't have that much content, so I mean it was literally like on a loop.
Right,
it's crazy.
But it was a great song, man.
Yeah,
it's a great song, a great memorable tune. I mean, the tune is just. It was.
It made us.
It really. It had a hook. It was catchy. It was beautiful.
Melodic.
It was lyrical.
Yes, yeah.
Melodic. I mean, I'm not. I mean, I'm telling you the truth. It was a really great song, man.
So that winds up catapulting y'all into this whole other level where you're out there touring with U2 and the Kinks and you know, all these people. It was crazy. And then
you did our second video too.
Yeah.
Yes, at the same time, like I guess the record company was so happy with China and China, like you're saying, you did it on spec, but you did like all the storyboards yourself. Everything was all in house. That was all you know. You had control over all of it.
Completely, yeah. So, with me and the band, I mean, we talked about it. We all commiserated, you know, about ideas and what do you think of this and what do you think of that? Oh, that's cool, man. You know, and I remember talking to you and I'm sure it was you and John and everybody about, hey, what about we get some school kids, you know, to come dance alongside, you know? And I'm trying to remember.
Where did you find those kids?
In New Orleans
their mothers,
East.
You can see them on the side. Like
New Orleans East.
Okay.
The Vietnamese community,
all right,
out New Orleans East, and
still
we
a powerful community out there. Yeah, yeah.
Oh God, yeah, they're well entrenched there.
Oh yeah,
hardworking,
yeah.
You know, very successful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People that were, you know, brought over because of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially,
a great addition to our community.
We called.
Yeah, yeah.
I think my mother or somebody said, well, you want to get some kids in. Call the schools and the churches.
Right,
and we started making phone calls to them, and they
you
were
couldn't
like,
do that today though because they'd want to. You know,
oh no,
see your,
I mean yeah, you're yeah, right, but yeah, they would just said, oh that's today. Oh that sounds beautiful, that sounds beautiful, really,
yeah.
My kid's gonna be in a, on film and TV whatever.
Yeah,
said, yeah, yeah, they're gonna be in, we're shooting a film and they're gonna be in it.
Sign this waiver.
Yeah, and they, yeah, well they had to. Everybody did.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
That was
sure.
That was
yeah,
the way the business
yeah.
was run. But yeah,
well and so it's interesting. So the again, the fact that this is like the pivotal point in your career that launches you into this whole thing where you wind up having this huge, not just commercial career and video director career, but television and movies and all. And you know, I have so much to talk to you about, but maybe we don't have time to get into all of it. But I am interested in the Roger Corman part, because mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated by this kind of underbelly of showbiz, you know. So can you give us any pearls of, you know, like, interest on that subject of this 1994 production of Fantastic Four?
Yeah, the Fantastic Four. Well, you know, and just the lead up to that was I directed 100 videos, you know, and I became friends with they're very big directors now, David Fincher and Michael Bay. We were all doing videos at the same time. Okay. And that's we can save that for another story. But they're both great guys. I mean, really, I've got to be pretty good friends with Fincher, nice. At the time. And then another girl who was producing for me, all of my videos. She was producing all the videos with me. It was Callie Corey, who was sitting at an old computer in the office working after we'd leave. I said, "What are you doing, Kelly?" She says, "Well, I'm working on this script. I got to get this thing done. I just got to get this thing done." I said, "Okay, cool." Didn't think about it, you know. She's working on it. 6 months later, she's got the script. I said, she's pulling the paper off of the printer. It's like dot matrix, you know, with the perforated pages.
Right.
You know?
Brr, brr,
brr. And she puts it together, and she staples it all together, and she says, "Oli, do me a favor, read this, would you please? I'd love to hear what you think." And I read the script, and I said, "Callie, it's freaking great. This is a great script." She goes, "You think so? Really?" I said, "Hell yeah." So one thing led to the next. She gave it to this person, who gave it to that person. They got the movie made. The movie was Thelma and Louise.
Okay.
And she won an Academy Award.
All right. Oh. Well, you were right.
First screenplay.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
that led up to me.
And she hasn't worked since.
She did the series, the TV show Nashville.
Okay.
She wrote and created that, among other things. But she was great. Really great. Loved it.
That's Hollywood, baby. You're only as good as your last
thing. You never know.
And you win an award, and then you're out of work.
Well, you're right. You know, to a lot of people regret that they've won big awards.
To an apartment in Venice. Exactly. Yeah.
I've heard stories where the people use the Academy Award for a doorstop.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a blessing and a curse. But then,
got involved in this Corman.
Well, I wrote up a film that got made, co-wrote it with a friend of mine who I met at UNO, who became a big television writer producer. Matt Williams, he created Roseanne, and he created Home Improvement.
Okay, yeah.
So,
Roseanne and Tim Allen created those shows. He just helped
That's true. Well, you know, but he had to take what they created and turn it into a format for television, for
exactly,
sitcom.
Yeah.
Because he was writing for The Cosby Show, you know, as a staff writer. But we met at UNO in theater. So we got that done. And
he was writing plea deals for Cosby, wasn't he, too?
He's what? Anyway, look, everybody I know that's done what they've done, including myself, and you guys know, I mean, it's hard work. You work. And it's very competitive. And believe me, if you're not up in the morning working on something out there, you're left behind. You just
somebody else's.
20 freaking years of my life, every single day.
See, you know, unlike New Orleans,
focus.
You know? Nobody works.
Unlike
down here.
New Orleans, where if you get up and you do one thing in the day, you're ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Look, that's all right. That's part of the charm, you know. But that's just that business. That's, you know. Well, look. Anyway,
Darren, when you laugh, you got to laugh in the mic, man. Every time you laugh, you pull a mic away from your face.
Well,
now, sorry to pivot from this.
So then I go to my manager says, "Look, you know, we get your movie right now, because everybody out there has to have a feature." And, you know, Steven Soderbergh is from Baton Rouge.
Right.
You know, auteur, though. He wrote something that really took off. And I got to be friends with Steven. And he was talking about it, you know, and after he won the Palme d'Or, he had freaking no idea that the movie was going to do any business at all, much less win the highest award at Cannes. But, you know, I kept struggling with that thing. And I still, to this day, you know, I've written a few movies that got made, but there weren't those big breakout movies, you know. If you want something to happen, it's in, like in the music business, right, Darren? I mean, if you want to hit it, you got to have a hit.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah.
A hit is a hit, you know, right. Whether it's a film or a song.
Sure. But movies and music, I mean, you probably experienced, you had a hit with China here, but maybe China wasn't big in South America. Maybe it wasn't big in Europe. Like films are, like some American films are hits in Europe. Like Weekend at Bernie's.
Right.
I mean, huge hit France. In Europe.
Yeah.
Here in the States, they called it, you know, everything from shit to fucking shit. You know? You know? So it all goes, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, my manager says, you know, I can get you a gig with Roger Corman. And I knew who Roger Corman was from being in the movie business.
Right.
He gave that first job to Francis Coppola, to Martin Scorsese. James Cameron.
Spielberg, right?
Spielberg didn't do a movie for Roger.
Oh, I thought
he did. No,
okay.
He didn't.
Right.
Yeah, he's
but
right.
But Gail Ann Hurd, okay. I mean.
Ron Howard.
Right.
And it's interesting because out of that group of people just mentioned, I met James Cameron because he was directing a video for Bill Paxton, because Bill Paxton was in a band called Martini Ranch, and they used our production company in L.A. to produce the production company I was working with. They used that company to produce the video with James Cameron and Bill Paxton. So I got to be friends with Bill Paxton, and then he agreed to do a short film with me. So I did my first short film, and then that short film called The Roommate was shown to some people in town, and Roger Corman said, okay, hey, you want to come make a movie for me? You're welcome. And my first movie was with Richard Roundtree, who was the original Shaft.
Yeah.
Wow.
Tremendous.
Yeah, and he was so damn good.
Yeah.
And man, he was great to work with. And it was a prison film, and it took place in one location, a prison. So it I know it sounded redundant, but the point is, when you have an 18-day shooting schedule and you don't have to move the circus and you're in one location, it gives you more time to make the movie.
Right.
And the script was really good because one of the script writers did 8 years in prison for bank robbery.
Okay, so he knew the subject.
Oh, it was the real deal, man.
Right.
So that movie did really well. So then I made a couple more movies for Roger, and then Roger calls me out of the blue and says, and he had an interesting way of speaking, you know, rest in peace, Roger. But he said, oh, Lehi, it's Roger. Would you like to do a movie based on the comic, The Fantastic Four? And I went, fuck yeah. And because I was a comic book kid, you know.
Right.
And Marvel was the comics that I loved. I loved Spider-Man first and foremost, but Fantastic Four was right up there. So I said, yeah, I'm going to do the movie, man. Let's go do the movie. Of course, no money. I mean, but we made a good movie. And we come to find out, after we make this movie, we go through all of these machinations of making the film, and I'm not going to get into all the gory details.
Yeah.
Roger's getting ready to release the film at the Mall of the Americas, and we're all excited. Yeah, we're going to have a movie. All right, it's going out. And then at the last minute, they pull the plug. We're like, what the fuck happened? Roger calls me on the phone. I'll never forget it. I'm on San Vicente Boulevard in L.A. Mm-hmm. He goes, holy, it's Roger. I'm sorry. We're not going to be able to release the film. They paid me an extra $1 million not to release it. Thank you for making a good film. Click.
That was it.
It
got buried. Yeah, all right.
But what the fuck happened? Well, turns out, and now it's known all over the Marvel Universe and the rest of the universe, that the film was just made for contractual obligation to the production company that owned the rights to the Fantastic Four. They had it in their contract with Marvel to make a movie about the Fantastic Four.
And it could have been a 10-minute movie. It could have been
anything. Just get it into production. Because we started the production in December at the end of that year.
Yeah.
But finished it in January of the next year.
Yeah.
But they satisfied the contractual obligation to keep the rights.
Yeah.
But we didn't know that.
Right.
We thought we were everybody, the cast and crew, we thought we were just making a movie.
Do you own a print of it? Do you have a print?
They would never give us a print.
No.
But it got bootlegged.
Oh.
So it's out there. And for years, it's been horrible because it's been VHS to VHS to VHS. But somebody with the new technology with AI and such cleaned up the print. And it's pristine, and it looks freaking fabulous. And I'm not blowing smoke or making its bullshit up. Every, just 9 out of 10, I'd say 95% to 98% of the Fantastic Four Marvel fans like our movie better than all of the other movies they've made up to now.
Wow.
And there's a new one coming out now this summer. But I'm not kidding. If you go online and you look, type in Roger Corman 1994 Fantastic Four movie, you'll see the clips of the film, and it became such a big deal that the casting director and another guy made a documentary about what happened to us.
Right. What's that called?
And that
Doomed.
Movie's called Doomed.
Yes. Wow.
And that movie right now is on Amazon.
Okay.
On Prime Video.
All right, I might have to put a link to that in the show notes of this show. Yeah,
I mean, it's a nutty story.
I love
but
that.
Here we are 30 years later, and people are still talking about our movie.
So cool.
Our movie.
Right?
They're still talking about
it. It's like an underground cult classic.
It's a cult film, man. I get caught.
Anybody in the film that's now still relevant? You know, any actor?
Well, look, I think all these guys are... And well, there's the other thing.
I'm still working.
Everybody in the film, all the cast members, and this is totally unheard of in L.A., we're like a family.
Yeah.
We are so close to one another to this day.
It's like me and Manny. No, just kidding.
But I'm just telling you, man.
Get a rise out of
what happened to us just melded a relationship with us like we're brothers and sisters. Like, how dare they come fuck with our family?
Right.
You know? And anyway, it was Joseph Culp, whose dad was Robert Culp.
Robert Culp.
I went to school with a daughter, Rebecca.
And with Robert Culp?
Yeah, well, with Robert Culp's daughter.
That's Joseph's brother. That's got to be his sister.
Yeah.
No, I went to high school with Rebecca Culp.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Dude, Joseph
Culp. She got around. Let me just tell you that.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Well, she
was tall
Alex
glass
Hyde
of water.
White.
Tall
I
glass
dug
of water.
Her,
okay.
She was a
and the guy, the guy who played Reed Richards, Alex Hyde White. His dad is Wilfred Hyde White, the English actor who's in the musical My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he's done a lot. You'd recognize him if you saw him. But anyway, check out the documentary Doom that'll tell you everything you need to know about what happened to us.
Fascinating story.
I became really good friends with Stan Lee.
Cool.
And I used to go up to the Marvel office of his office on Wilshire Boulevard near Westwood, and I'd go to hang out with Stan Lee. And this is before all the big Marvel movies came out.
Right.
And he pulled out a comic book called The Femazons that was an unpublished Stan Lee, Jack Kirby comic. And he said, "Here, check this out." I said, "Wow, this is cool, man. This is like it's kind of like a Xena thing where women ruled the earth." And I said, "What do I do with it?" He says, "Well, I don't know. Well, let's do something with it, man." I said, so we went and got meetings. I called my agent and my manager and said, we have to, look, man, I got this Stan Lee comic. And they set up meetings for us at Paramount, Universal, Warner Brothers Television. And I went to meetings. Stan Lee and me went to meetings to all these fucking studios, and not one of them picked up the fucking idea to make it into a TV show. And Stan and I would go to a restaurant in Westwood, and Stan Lee would be sitting at the table with me complaining about how come nobody wants to make my stuff into a big movie or TV show. He would be moaning that to me.
Right.
And we're trying to get his comic book made into a TV show, and these fuckheads out there they just wanted to meet Stan. "Oh, so happy to meet you, Stan. Can I, you need something? You want, get you a coffee, a little cup? You want some water? You know?" No, fuck you, man. We want to make a TV show.
Right.
Well, they finally
now,
caught up
and
with
Stan. Now
with
they've
Stan
made
Lee.
So yeah, much yeah. Marvel bull crap in the last 20 years. It's unwatchable, this stuff.
Well, some of it is not too good, I have
to
say.
It's just unwatchable.
It's hard for me to say.
So, restaurant in Westwood, was it Mustache Cafe? You said you had a restaurant. Or was it Hamburger Hamlet?
It was one of those. It was right What's the other street that goes in there? Westwood and Gaylord, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Gaylord and Rayburn.
Right on the corner there.
So you probably at the
brick
mustache.
Building,
the brick building, yes.
Old brick on the corner. There's a restaurant
right across
the
street from the Village Theater.
Yeah, that's where he used to go with Stan.
Yeah, that's an Italian place with
his,
the brick.
His office, if I'm not mistaken, was in the Oppenheimer building.
Oh.
On Wilshire.
Okay. Well, that's why they didn't want to make his film.
Anyway,
let's get to this other guy.
Come on, Darren.
So we're right on the downslope of the podcast, and but Darren, I'm so excited about if you recall last year, it was a Saturday night again that the first Red Rockers reunion happened, and someone called me for a gig that night, and I turned him down.
That's right.
And this year, the same thing happened. I turned him down. I was like, no, I have somewhere I have to be that night, man.
There's no greater honor than that.
Oh.
And he turned down a gig. Can you believe that?
I know.
Wow, I know. He's a fucking money-grubbing...
Sacrilege.
Right?
No, I just love to play, man. That's it. No, I don't care about money. I'm not doing this for money.
Oh,
yeah. Well,
clearly.
Thank you.
But man, I'm so excited. And, you know, my thought is that, well, a lot of people came last year and had a blast, and they're all going to come back. And then there's a lot of other people that couldn't come last year, and they heard about what a great time they missed, and they're all going to come if they can.
Oh. Yeah, it's going to be a great night. It really is.
Yeah, man. And
yeah, last year was great.
Oh, yeah. You were there, Ole?
Hell yeah.
Okay, yeah. I was there. I wasn't there. It was tremendous. No. Well, you won't be there again, right?
No, I'm not going to. Okay. Unless I get on the guest list.
Well, I think we might be able to swing that, you know?
Can you put me plus nine? I only go if you put me plus nine.
Nine?
Yeah, nine.
He doesn't have nine friends. He'll just find nine people out on the street to bring
people.
In.
Like this guy right there.
Yeah, just
that
glue head sitting out in front tonight. Yeah. It's going to be Manny's plus
nine. I will guarantee I'll be there plus nine. I will.
But,
you got it, Manny.
All right, okay, thank you. I'll be there.
Darren's a soft touch, man.
Yeah.
Well, I know this was originally scheduled for November of this year.
But then
I think you thought, well, I'm not sure how this election is going to turn out. It might be a
might be a tough
season. Speaking of glue heads, here we go. There he is. there's your guest, Manny. There's your plus. Plus nine.
I'll be there. I guarantee.
You thought better of it. You thought,
yes.
Let's see, maybe.
Reassessed it.
Whatever happens, it'll maybe die down by then. Well, it shows you how wrong you were.
How wrong I was.
And in fact, I heard that there was rumors swirling that there were going to be protests outside of Tipitina's. I don't know where that came from, but that's not true. That's
No, that's not true.
Oh.
It's going to be all peace and love and rock and roll.
I think that was Antifa.
All right. Yeah, you know, you see, you got to watch this troublemakers all around, man. But that night, it's going to be great.
It's going to be so good. And we have two great opening acts from...
Yes.
Actually, we're on bills with us in 1982. So
since the time you were on, actually, because I saw him, Brad Ogeron, saw him perform.
Oh, I listened to that. That was a great podcast.
At the Red Rockers reunion. I was like, I got to fucking get this guy on, man.
Oh, yeah.
And he came on. He was great.
I mean, he's
came
cool
on with
character.
Damien Youth
is.
And but so he's performing with the Contenders, I imagine.
Yes.
Cool. Man.
Mike Saravola, who was in the Models,
okay,
the Contenders, but he's the CEO of Schecter Guitars.
Oh, is he?
Oh, dude, is he going to be there Saturday?
Yeah.
Oh. That cat, man, is he still with Schecter? Is he still?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my
still
God.
So, man,
that
guy's,
oh, that's so cool.
Going to be a hell of a night, people.
It is.
This will come out after that, so we're not actually promoting it.
Yeah, well, you losers, you missed it.
If you weren't there, you missed it.
You missed it, yeah. Well, all right, I think we've got a show.
Yeah, well, this time, don't miss it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well,
and we're going to have Manny here.
Yeah,
Manny plus nine glue heads.
I will be there.
We're doing a small tribute to David Johansen, too.
Yes, I was saying we lost. Sadly, we lost David Johansen. I know you were good friends with David. And man, when he passed, I went back and listened to that first Dolls record, and Holy shit, man.
Holy shit is right.
The guitar tones on that record, the songs, everything is so fucking powerful,
well,
man.
You know, he'll always be Buster Poindexter to me.
Oh, sure.
He will be. I
understand,
that
man.
Other stuff, I, you know, whatever, but he'll always
he
be.
He can take or leave
you
the
dolls.
You
knew him very well. Yeah. You knew him, Darren?
Yeah.
You knew
him? Well, I managed David Johansen for 12 years and did the Dolls reunion. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he facilitated all that stuff, man. All the Meltdown Festival performance and
well, I saw.
I tried to do one of the videos for him for the song called Hot, Hot, Hot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Buster.
That was his
big hit.
Big hit.
Yeah.
He had done that, yeah.
I tried.
I saw him at the Greek Theater in L.A., and Gilbert Gottfried opened for him. You talk about a great double fucking bill.
Yeah.
Gilbert Gottfried opened for Buster at the Greek Theater in L.A.
Wow.
One of the best shows I've ever seen in my fucking life.
Wow.
Really. That's Gilbert cool, was, man. You know, Gilbert. You know?
Sure.
and then Buster came out, and he would talk between songs. And this one fucking woman, because I got great seats in the orchestra and all that, this one woman's like going, why don't you start singing? He's like, and pissed him off big time. I'm doing my gig here. I'm doing my act. And he railed into her big time. And then he went into a song. And this last song, he walked into the audience. And he walked by that woman who was giving him shit. And he went like this.
Shook his fist in her face.
I'm going to fucking punch you in the fucking face, bitch.
Okay.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant. Well, yeah, it was a good show. Anyway, we got to go.
Well,
I've got to go find 9 people.
Yeah. Nine people you can pretend to be friends with.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Darren and Oli. This has been tremendous, man. My life is really coming full circle here. It's all coming together.
Thank you, man.
And as always on the Troubled Men podcast, we like to say trouble never ends.
But the struggle continues. Good night.
Good night.